Welcome to More Than a Refresh, a podcast about data and the people who wrangle it. Today, our guest is Dr. Michael Mesks, and we are recording from Bellingham, Washington, Astoria, Queens, and Dusseldorf, Germany. I actually spelled that right in the document. Hey, Michael, introduce yourself a little bit. I know that you're the general manager, owner, not owner, still of Creditive.
I used to be. So let me back up a little bit. Might be interesting for people. I got into open source in the early 90s as a developer. So I have more than 30 years of open source development. And as you know, I'm still a Postgres developer, spend a lot of time in that community. I'm a Debian developer, spend time there. And then in early 2000, or actually late 99, we started Creditive as the company and one of the founders. And then acted as the what we call managing director until 2021, when we merged with InstaCluster. I stayed as the director, as the general manager for the company. Then InstaCluster was acquired by NetApp. And in that process, we all got moved over to NetApp. So now I'm a senior director of cloud products at NetApp. And the Creditive entity, I'm no longer, well, involved with a Creditive entity that does still exist, but has no employees anymore.
Okay. You said since the 90s, I too have been in open source since the 90s. I actually remember the first patch I ever sent to Linux kernel. I didn't write the patch, but was compatibility for the Sony CDU, I think it was 34A. CD-ROM drive, because I mean, back then it wasn't IDE, it wasn't SATA, it wasn't anything like that. When you got a CD-ROM drive, they give you a controller card that you had to have, you know, a driver for. And my first modification to the Linux kernel was to change it so that it would support 64 slip channels instead of only 16.
Doesn't sound like a big patch, but still something that needed to be done. And you know, just when you say that, keep reminding the or remembering the mode lines we had to do for the X server.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the moments where I think, no, it wasn't the good old times. It's much better now.
In some ways, I mean.
Yeah.
I've been running Linux as my primary desktop. I mean, I'm running Linux, I mean, Android on this tablet to do the podcast, but I run Ubuntu on my Dell here. And I haven't run Windows in... I probably haven't run Windows as a primary desktop since 97.
I never ran Windows as my primary desktop.
Well,
my
that's
Linux
good.
Desktop was earlier than Windows 3, 11, whatever it was.
Yeah, I mean, I ran it, but I mean, it was until KDE like 0.99 in my mind before it could actually be a replacement. Now,
agreed.
I mean, in today's world, you know, I hear everyone say, oh, I can't run Linux because X. And that X is usually not real. I mean, I use LibreOffice or Google Docs. I don't need Word or Excel, you know.
Okay, fair enough. And you could use Word in the browser. You can do Office 365, yeah. So you get Word. Most Word documents, as long as they are not too complicated, you can do with LibreOffice.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I agree with that. I guess there is software where it's a problem, maybe some special accounting software or whatever. I don't know. But there might be maybe something.
Well, definitely in some enterprises like SAP, for example, right? Or QuickBooks is a good example, although you can do that online now. One of the greatest gifts, the greatest gifts to open source is actually being able to do a lot of the things that you used to have to do in an app, you do now on the web.
Correct. And I think everything we mentioned is available as a, I call it a cloud service now.
Mm-hmm.
So the desktop is essentially just that, what your tablet offers you. as a normal user, if you just want to do a couple of things, you don't need more than a tablet.
No, agreed. I'm probably, well, my phone too. Frankly, when we did Silicon, not this year, but in 2022, when we did the Silicon Valley conference, EFF gave their keynote off my phone. I plugged in a USB-C to HDMI, boom, you know. And Samsung specifically, I'm sure Apple has its equivalent, but Samsung specifically, you plug it into a monitor and it immediately turns to desktop mode.
That's nice, isn't it?
Yeah, it's quite nice. In fact, if I was better on a touch screen, I probably would only need the tablet, but I need a keyboard and mouse.
I can do without the mouse, but I cannot write longer texts without a keyboard.
Yeah.
And I don't like the idea of having to, well, dictate it into the system, because there more often than not people are around, and I don't want everyone to listen what I'm writing.
Yeah, I find that people don't want to hear my cussing and swearing as much as I'd like to write it out.
Fair enough.
So you're a Debian developer. You know, a lot of people don't even realize, you know, in our world, of course, people realize this. But if you talk to, you know, random Joe on the street and you're like, do you know what Linux is? They're like, yeah, it's Ubuntu or Red Hat. Right. Or if you're in Europe, maybe SUSE. They don't necessarily know about Debian or Arch or any of these actually very popular distributions. What is it like being a Debian developer?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned Ubuntu, because Ubuntu is essentially, well, a Debian fork.
Yes.
And a lot of work in the project is done with joint teams between Debian and Ubuntu.
Right.
Yes, there's Canonical behind Ubuntu, and there's no company behind Debian, but that's the major difference.
Well, hold on. I mean, there kind of is a company. It's a nonprofit, but there is kind of a company behind Debian. It's Software in the Public Interest.
But Software in the Public Interest is not a company.
Yes, they are.
At least not in the sense that it's trying to sell something.
Well, no, it's not a for-profit. It's a nonprofit, but it is a corporation.
Yeah, but it's not selling anything. It's a non-profit, and the money it gets in is, it doesn't have any products to sell.
Well, neither does Command Prompt. We're still a company.
Yeah, but you sell services. SPI doesn't sell services either.
So my point here, so you're making the distinction based on the fact that, one, it's not a company because it doesn't sell something.
Okay, maybe the wording is an issue here, but the difference to me between Canonical and Software in the Public Interest is that Canonical, as a commercial entity, as you said, wants to draw a profit, but also tries to get their products, their services out of it. They try to monetize the distribution.
No, agree.
SPI doesn't try to monetize Debian.
No, you're right, That's not actually what my point was. My only point was is there is actually a corporation, there is lawyers, there is
correct
all that does exist and help protect Debian. That was my only point.
That I agree.
I mean, and it's the same. I mean, for PostgreSQL, right? I mean, the international advocacy efforts are funneled through Software in the Public Interest.
Correct.
So,
and I think as a larger project, you need some legal entity behind it. Somebody has to carry the trademark. Somebody has to defend the trademark.
Yep.
And people and companies are donating money. Somebody has to take care of that. Somebody has to take care of accounting of tax, of communicating with tax authorities, paying taxes, whatever. So you need something behind it, some legal entity.
That's actually a really good point. You know, one of the things that you run into is a lot of people are like, why don't you just set up a GoFundMe or a donation page or something like that? And individual developers, generally speaking, have no idea what that actually means. Sure, it's easy enough to plug in a form, but if all of a sudden you have $50,000 in quote-unquote donations directly, personally to you, what does that mean? There's liability concerns, there's taxation concerns, there's all these things that the developer all of a sudden, what am I doing? Right? And it's frustrating because you run into a lot of people that are like, you don't need a company. You need a legal entity. You should, if you are going to conduct any kind of commerce, and let's be honest, it's not necessarily monetary commerce, right? If I spend time coding and I release that into the wild and then I have users, that's a transaction. You shouldn't do, in my opinion, you shouldn't do that without at least in the United States, an LLC. Is it annoying? Yes, but you should have that protection.
Correct. I completely agree. And you and I, we've both been running companies for a major part of our life.
Yes.
I still have one. You still have yours. Mine is not operating in that area anymore. But anyway, we know that it is a lot of effort. And there's a lot of effort that is not related to the software you're doing, that's not related to the services you're providing, not related to the products you're doing. Just additional add-on that you have to go through, be it accounting, be it taxes, be it legal stuff. And yes, I agree. In the US, it should be an LLC. Over here, it's called GmbH. There are other ways to do it, but I wouldn't like to do some of those. You want to make sure the liability is, well, at least you have an idea how much it is, and it's not your whole personal wealth.
Yeah, I don't know, but in the States, it's very easy to sue someone. And I would hate to be that one developer who puts something out in the wild. And it doesn't matter if the license says X. It really doesn't. It matters whether or not the company that something happened to is angry enough to bankrupt you. That's what matters. And I think a lot of people don't think about that. They don't think, well, I'm running the GPL, and the GPL specifically says use at your own risk. That's irrelevant. If I download your software and your software hurts me in some way, causes me financial harm to the point where I'm irritated enough, I can make a phone call and to an attorney, and if it's depending on the attorney, they're going to be happy to spend my money to destroy your life, right?
They make money of it. That's their life.
Yeah, exactly.
I get that part. It doesn't make a difference in the US whether you sell the software or you give it away for free.
Yeah. So in the end, result would probably be the person walks away. Right. That's the judge. Any judge or good lawyer on the defendant side is going to be able to show, that it was free software or that here's the license. That's not the problem. The problem is how long and how much money you spend getting to that point.
Gotcha. Actually, I think what I mentioned is a different level, but also a problem because nothing in the GPL says you must not sell the software. You have to give the source code, but you can easily sell it, as we've seen a lot of companies do.
It actually explicitly says that in the GPL.
Right. My understanding, and I'm not a lawyer, but my understanding of the legal system, at least over here, is it makes a huge difference. With selling the software comes a certain set of liabilities. If you give it away literally as a gift for free, those liabilities do not apply.
Yeah, I would imagine that would be the case here. I'm not a lawyer either. But again, my concern for especially these individual developers is it's how much it costs for them to get to the point where the court says this is a bogus lawsuit. Right? You could spend $100,000 doing that.
Fortunately, that's easier here. And that risk is not as high over here. But there are other risks that might be higher. I don't know. I always found it interesting how easy how easily people are persuaded in the US to sign something. Here's the document. Please sign. Okay, where do I sign? Well, I'm like, I haven't read it yet. I don't understand the legal implications. So I go to somebody to explain it to me before I sign anything.
I think, I mean, you're right. In the U.S., people are willing to do that. And I think that we got conditioned to it. And I'll give you an example. If you buy a house in the United States, I mean, you get a stack of paper this thick and you've got to sign 50, 60 times. I have never read my mortgage agreement on any house that I've bought. I just sign. Why? Because they're regulated. So if there's anything in there that's perverse, it's going to come out in the end and it's going to be thrown out in court. So I don't worry about that. But that same, well, laziness, that same lack of diligence can apply in other places. And a perfect example is the U.S. healthcare system. You go to a doctor, you don't know how much shit's going to cost. And then you get a $5,000 bill and you're like, all I did was X, whatever X may be. And they're like, well, you owe us $5,000. You've got to pay it.
Mm-hmm. And you don't ask beforehand because nobody usually does.
Right. So, and nowadays it's getting better. There's a lot of doctors that are now, they'll actually give you extreme discounts if you don't use your insurance. Like I just found out. So I just turned 50 in May. We talked a little bit about this before we started recording. Mm-hmm. And I don't know about in Europe, but in the States, when you turn 50 as a man, you get your panel done, right? You get all your blood, your cholesterol, your diabetes, your potential prostate issues, all that stuff. And I was going to go to the doctor, but they were having me sit out 6 weeks. So just for grins, I said, cash only blood test near me. And Google, being the almighty God it is now, said, go here. So I went to this website and I paid $50, which is less than what I would have paid to insurance. And I picked the tests I wanted, the PSA and the cholesterol, mm-hmm. and the full panel and testosterone and all that stuff. And then I made an appointment. I walked in the next day. They took my blood. 2 days later, my results were uploaded. Had I gone through the quote-unquote medical system, that would have taken weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks.
But wouldn't it have been free for you then if you went through the system?
No, because we have what's called a copay, and then we have a deductible.
Okay, gotcha. Mm-hmm.
So it probably would have been. I probably didn't really save any money. Probably would have been $50. But then if I go through the system, this is what happens: I pay my $50, and then they only cover like 85% or whatever it is, right? There's what's called co-insurance.
Mm-hmm.
There is for normal stuff, like if I'm just going in for a checkup, that's just my annual checkup, that's all covered. But anything that's not specifically the doctor saying, I want you to do this, they're going to charge you for it. You know, my MRI, I'm probably going to end up paying $500 for my MRI from my ankle. It's different than in Europe, but what a lot of people don't realize is that while yes, in Europe, you just kind of go to the doctor. I actually looked into this. I got into an argument with Andreas, ads, mm-hmm. Years and years ago about this, because he could not understand the American medical system, which I get, but if you look on average at the amount of money you pay into the U.S. medical system, the difference between that as a choice versus the difference that you pay in taxes by force, it's about the same. So if we went to a universal healthcare program that was tax funded, my financial position wouldn't change. It would just be going to taxes instead of into my pocket and then out of my pocket. So I don't know which is better. I know which one's easier, but I don't know which one's better.
So technically, ours isn't tax funded. So the same way we are paying taxes, we also have to pay for health insurance.
Oh, interesting.
So it's directly taken from, my employer only pays me the net amount, and the rest for taxes and so on goes to other people or well, the government, and or in this case, the health insurance. But the government-run system or the government-organized system is something where you only can get out of the system when you cross a certain threshold in terms of salary. And then you're on your own. You can do whatever you want, get a better insurance, but you can also go without one. Then you have to pay for it yourself. But by and large, people are in the government-run system. And yes, it's taken away as if it was a tax. I don't think it's that much, but it's a different way of, let's say, thinking about it. We are well known, or we only know that way. We grew up in a system where you have a health insurance from day one of your life. Government made sure of it. And most people do not have a choice. They cannot say, I don't want it. I want to go into some private version, as in pay myself. Just not possible.
So that's kind of interesting. So if you're in the States, you know, obviously we're a little different because, I mean, we have states, right? And states have certain rights and they can make their own rules. But generally speaking, all states, if you're of a lower income, you have a choice to go on insurance. You're not provided it by default. Mm-hmm. Right? So it's there. Right. You, if I am of a lower income, I can go and I, like in Washington, in fact, they just changed the name, but it used to be called Apple Care. You could go and I, you know, I don't make this much money, but I need insurance. And they go, here you go. You got health insurance and you can go wherever you need to go to get yourself taken care of. But it's a choice. And I think one of the problems that we run into in the States is that we are so poorly educated about how the system works that a lot of people don't know or realize we have these systems.
Yeah. Right?
We do have systems for the poor. We do have systems for healthcare. We do have systems for the elderly. We do have emergency services, but we're never educated about them. And so what happens is that if you're, you know, a young lady who happens to get pregnant, for example, you're working at Starbucks or whatever, you're making minimum wage, you didn't even know that you could go and just go down the road and sign this piece of paper and now you have health insurance. You just don't know. Which, I mean, that has nothing to do with what we were talking about, but it was just, it just kind of struck me as how poorly educated our system now makes people, right? I mean, I don't know about Germany, but our schools don't teach personal finance.
I'm tempted to say
by mandatory, as a mandatory class, they do teach as an elective.
I don't think we have one either. We, by the way, we also have states, but stuff like health insurance is a federal thing, so it's not by state for us.
Germany, I thought. You have states, you have
states.
Counties. You have 60
no, we have states.
Germany's not that big.
We still have states.
How big is Germany? I mean, the maps are always wrong, right?
Something like between Montana and California, something like that.
Let's see. You're 138,000 square miles, 357,000 kilometers square. And let's see, California. Yeah, you're a little smaller than California. California is not actually all that big in compared to, say, Texas.
Oh, Texas is much bigger. Texas is almost like Western Europe.
Yeah, Texas is actually not as much as you would think. France and Texas are about the same size.
I doubt that. I highly doubt that.
Okay, let's check. Texas is 268,000 square miles. France is 213,000 square miles. That's a big difference, but it's pretty close.
Yeah.
And when you're talking about that big, right?
I thought Texas was more like Western Europe, as in Spain, France, Germany, and some of the smaller countries combined.
Now, if you were to put, I mean, because Spain's not huge, but I mean, it's big enough to where it would definitely be bigger than Texas. Oh, no, actually, Spain's big. Spain's 195,000 square miles.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now Alaska. Alaska's definitely.
Yeah, so maybe Alaska's it's Alaska.
Gargantuan.
Yeah, although
Alaska's
when you look,
665,000 square miles is Alaska.
Yeah, so that's Western Europe. But the interesting thing with Texas is almost all of the population lives in a very small area.
Yeah, there's basically Austin / San Antonio, Dallas, and Houston.
Yeah, that's exactly. If you could look at this triangle, it's probably the size of my state here and probably the same population. Just the difference is the rest of Texas is fairly empty by comparison compared to my home country.
Yes, absolutely. There's a lot of small towns in Texas. Okay, so let's now that we've been chatting about all kinds of weird stuff, let's talk about Creditive a little bit. Obviously, it's not really operating anymore, right? Is that correct?
Well, the legal entity is not. That's correct. The team is still doing the same work. We're still serving the same customers. Nothing in that area has changed. It's just the legal streamlining towards the NetApp entity that already existed in Germany. Why should they keep two entities?
Right. So, but it said, as a company, we are involved in social projects and place great importance on the sustainable and environmentally compatible method of operation.
Yeah.
Can you expound on that bullshit, please?
Wait, you call that bullshit?
It is a good stated goal, but explain what you mean by it.
Let me give you an example. The German team in the central Mönchengladbach office was about 45, 50 people. We had some people in other areas of Germany, and then, of course, the US team and so on, but they are not in the Mönchengladbach office. The office building has, let me quickly do the math, something like 26, 27, well, behind the building, let's say 30 parking spots. Out of those 30 parking spots, 19 have a wall box to charge the electric car.
Oh, I see. Okay.
There's photovoltaic on the building. The company has only used electricity provider that's fully concentrating on wind, water, whatever, but nothing that's not renewable, and has used that electricity provider for, I don't know, 15, 16, 17 years already. So this is the environmental side. But also we try to, well, let's call it a give and take. We want people to feel happy at what they do, and we want people to be able to have a life besides their job. On the other hand, of course, we have to fulfill work. We have to work for customers. We have to work even in the middle of the night if something breaks. Mm-hmm. So you always have to keep both sides in mind. And we have a lot of people who are of that age during that time frame, started a family, got kids and everything. And for all of that, you need also time. So you cannot, in my opinion, just say this is work and I don't care as a company. I don't care about the rest of it. We always try to take this all into account.
Well, I certainly agree with that. I mean, I recently wrote an article that says your work-life balance is killing you. In the States, there is this idea of a work-life balance.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with that is that, one, it immediately delegates work to something that's optional, right? And it's something that is considered bad. And you see it pervasively through the society, especially with younger people, about how corporations are greedy. They just want to take advantage of you, blah, blah, blah. And I agree 100%. A lot of corporations are terrible. But it's not the corporation that's the problem. It's the people within the corporation, right?
Correct.
And the whole article is about accepting that there is only a life balance. Because to be good at anything, you have to work. To be a good husband, you have to work. To be a good friend, you have to work. To be good at woodworking, you have to work. Right? So it has to become part of your life and part of your kind of your health outlook.
Agreed. I remember being in a business meeting early 2000s in the States, where somebody told me, this was one of my second, third trip to the US. And he said, you know, the US is a workaholic country.
Mm-hmm.
I can't understand that the younger generation doesn't want that anymore. And we see the same things here. Mm-hmm. We haven't been that much of a workaholic country, and I'm not sure if it holds for all of the US, but that's a different story. But I see more and more younger people come in and say, sure, I'm willing to work and I'm willing to work hard, no issue, but I'm not willing to do overtime. Or I might just want to, can I just work 4 days a week? I accept that I make less money. No problem with that. But I don't want to do the 40 hours. I want to do 30 hours, 32 hours, whatever it is, because I want to have some time for my hobbies, for my family, for my kids. And I get the point. And the advantage, of course, is for us in IT, we have those options. If you're working, as you said, at the Starbucks and making minimal salary, difficult, because you don't have enough to live off then.
Yeah, there's a phenomenon here, and it's in Europe too, but it's bigger here, which is like the van life, the nomad life type stuff. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of young folks who do this, and a lot of the people in our generation are older. They don't understand it. And because they're like, why aren't they getting a job? Why aren't they getting a career? And these are educated, educated young people, right? They're not just 17 years old and running off to live down by the river in a van, right? A lot of these people have degrees, but they're choosing to be willingly poor, or B, willingly beg, or at a minimum, not make as much money as they would if they had a quote unquote normal career, so that they can experience life beyond the greed.
Exactly. That's the point. You define life as something else than money. But really, I listened to people who said we're working all week, and then for Saturday or Sunday, finally have some spare time. What are we going to do? Go to the mall, buy something.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, but that's not a hobby. I mean, I buy something because I need something. I want to have time for my hobby or family or whatever it is. And I think, speaking for myself, I found somewhat of a middle way there. But the younger generation, by and large, puts much more emphasis on the non-working part of their life. And I can see the point.
I can too. The get off my lawn part of me says they haven't earned it yet. I mean, I'm 50, so I've worked literally since I was 12 years old. And now I experience a great deal of freedom. Now I have a great deal of responsibility, being that I have 20 families that rely on me to keep everything moving. But I have a great deal of freedom, and I worked hard for it. Now, honestly, I have three kids. All three of them can now be charged as an adult, so they're not my problem. But I gave up so much time that could have been time with my children to try and, make my paycheck.
Mm-hmm.
That I really, as much as I do think that a good portion of the younger generation, and not insubstantial portion, needs to grow up, get a job, and contribute to society. I believe, and I don't think there's 100% of them that are choosing to slack off, but I think there's probably 35% that they're doing it because they're just lazy. The other 65% are doing it because they're focusing on health. Their mental health, their relationship health, their physical health. And a lot of people don't realize Canada just recently made it so that you could prescribe. A doctor can now legally say, you need to go outside into nature.
Okay. Interesting.
Now you laugh. But the World Health Organization has an entire interactive map of places where humans do not get enough quiet.
Oh, don't get me wrong. I get the point of going outside, going into a quiet, into the forest or whatever. I laugh because it's a prescription.
Yeah, I mean, well, you have to tell people to do it. We have been so psychologically manipulated into this idea that, A, that cities are good. Cities are poison. That we need to get a normal job, work 60 hours a week. We need, you know, there's generations that were raised literally to create consumerism, to create profit for other people that are not you.
Yes. And looking from the outside, it seems to me that especially the US economy depends a lot on the citizens buying something.
Yes, absolutely.
And for that, you have to make enough money and for that, you have to work a lot. I think it's a balancing act. As you said, you have spent a lot of time and you worked hard to make your paychecks. The family and the kids needed the money too. It's not like you made more than anyone ever needed. And it's also a health issue. If you don't work and if you don't make enough money, you also get sick because you worry too much about stuff you cannot do and something breaks and you cannot afford the heating or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's a balancing act, but the current generation seems to try to balance it out a little bit better than maybe we did and definitely our parents did.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, parents in the 50s and 60s is a totally different thing. But the question I have, I think that I think the younger generation and the older generation, I think we're both missing a fundamental component of this. And you said it, there's got to be a balance. We have a society of certain, and that society has certain structures. And in theory, those structures are there to allow everyone some level of equity, right? Mm-hmm. That's the theory. But the older generation has taken, and it happens in every generation, but in every generation, the majority of the older population takes advantage of the younger population in some way until the younger population becomes the older population, you know, rinse, repeat. Do you know who REI is?
REI? Nope.
Okay. It's a U.S. corporation. It's a co-op. And they're one of the, if not the, they're one of the largest outdoor retailers in the nation. Okay, so mm-hmm. tents, backpacking gear, snow gear, that type of stuff. They've recently ran into a problem in that predominantly people that work at REI are old hippies or young, very active people. And they want to work at REI because it's a cool place to work and they're mountain climbers and they're hikers and they're mountain bikers and all this stuff. Well, REI only pays minimum wage.
Okay.
Because they're quote unquote retail. And this is the problem I think the older generation has. The older generation it has not correctly evolved their idea of commerce. It used to be pretty black and white. If you were in retail, you did, you know, you're selling clothes. If you're in, you know, if you're an electrician, you're wiring up houses or offices or whatever, right? Well, REI is an interesting mix of this problem in that they are paying people, let's say $15 an hour, to be not experts, but at least competent in being able to advise the best product to stop people from dying. Right?
Okay.
That's what we're talking about here. If I go out on a hike and I know nothing, if I know nothing and I like, I'm going to start hiking and I go to REI and the gal or the guy says, here, you need these boots, these socks, these shirts, these pants, and they're all cotton. And then I go on that hike and weather comes in I wasn't prepared for, I'm likely going to die because of hypothermia, because I'm wearing cotton. So we're expecting these people for $15 an hour. And where I live, you can't rent without roommates if you're on 15 bucks an hour, period. You cannot. You will have a roommate where I live. To be competent outdoor advisors. Okay. So the problem here is the older generation is using what they call market rate to determine your wage. Target pays $15 an hour. They're a retailer. Therefore, we're a retailer. We're going to pay $15 an hour. Now, the reason they do that is, and they won't say this out loud, but it's to artificially depress wages to artificially increase profits. REI uses this example, does this, in that they're not a retailer. They are a specialty equipment supplier, but they say they're a retailer so that they can charge retail rates or market rates, quote unquote. Well, I've come to the conclusion that whether it be Starbucks, it doesn't matter, Safeway, they're not charging market rate. They're charging competitor rate. Because market rate would demand a higher wage for someone for REI. Now, this is where I get into the REI part of it. You probably aren't, but I am generally anti-union.
Oh, same here.
Okay. I am generally anti-union. I do not like unions. I think that they create an artificial density of power that can subjectively cause great harm. The REI store in my town just voted to unionize, and I will not shop at that REI now. I will not cross because REI has not finished negotiations with that union. That's not normally something I would do. But REI has so demonstrably taken advantage of younger generation because of their passion. They can easily afford to pay, say $25 an hour. They charge. They're not a discount retailer, right? They're charging full MSRP on their stuff. They have the money, and they choose not to because they want to conflate their profit.
Yeah, but isn't that what most companies are trying to do?
Well, I think economically speaking, that's the point, right? Supply and demand make money. And there's nothing wrong with profit. Profit is a good thing. Profit is what drives growth. It's what drives investment. It's what drives, if you're in the medical industry, it's what drives research. No argument against profit. But I think that there is a point where we have to, and this is, I think, where the younger people are getting it right, is they're like, look, I don't care if you make profit. That makes sense. I care that you're taking advantage of me.
Yeah.
Right. Please.
Yeah, but there's this, let's call it social effect that you have to look into. As a company, you're not there just to make profit. You also have to think about what does it mean for your employees, and how do you how can you improve their life? And again, this is also for a company, this is a balance act. And a lot of companies probably don't do it right. I get that. And the younger generation doesn't want to play ball anymore. And I think we should applaud them, at least for some of that.
For some of it, absolutely. I think that what the older generation forgets, it is that it's all of our wealth that we have created, that we have stored, that we have invested, that is actually allowing these younger people to live a life we wish we could have when we were young.
Yeah.
Right? We're all sitting back going, damn it, I earned it. Why can't I do it? Well, you know what? I'm 50 years old. I'm not climbing Everest. It's just not going to happen. I got a blown ankle, arthritis in my back, you know? But it's almost like we should be to a certain degree, okay? I'm waxing poetic a little bit here, but I think that we should be inspired by the younger generation's willingness to say, enough is enough.
Yes. And they will come up with new models for life and for business. They will find a way. It's not the end of civilization. And if there's something I hate, it's the older generation saying the younger generation is the decline of civilization. No, that's not true. It has been said in ancient Greeks. The ancient Greeks already said it. And it has never been true. They find different ways, and that's good. I mean, society has to develop. Yeah, not always.
I mean, there's certain societies in history's past where the younger generation caused problems.
Sure, but there are also things where the older generation caused problems. So, yes, not everything is perfect.
As early as 2016, we had an older generation gentleman who somehow convinced over 50% of the United States that he was a Christian and a virtuous man, when in reality, he was a sexual harasser and enjoyed having sex with porn stars.
And technically, it wasn't even 50% of the U.S.
No, that's true. I mean, not from a popular vote perspective.
Right.
But he did. I mean, he wiped the electoral. I was stunned. I didn't vote for either
of them,
but I didn't vote for either of them. But when I saw that Hillary wasn't going to win, I just kind of sat there and stared at the screen. I was just like, oh my God, this is going to be a ride. You know?
Yep. And looking from the other side of the pond, it was even more astonishing.
Well, I mean, just a really simple thing. U2, the band U2 is one of my favorite bands. I grew up with them. And when Trump won, Bono came out and said, we're not releasing the record. We need to go back to the studio because the world just completely changed. They released the next record they released was just wasn't very good. Their heart wasn't in it because I think they thought the world was ending. But talking about the older generation, the younger generation, this actually brings us back around to a point in our outline here. What kind of responsibility or ethical obligation, that kind of thing, do companies have toward open source? Not legal. Legal's different. I'm talking about ethical.
Yeah, let's not care about legal. I mean, the legal language is clear, and most people kind of understand it or not. I mean, funny story aside, at one point we were asked to help a customer with their open source software. And we had to go by their procurement terms. So we are signing a contract that says support for open source software. Mm-hmm. And the procurement terms in the contract says you must not use open source software.
No.
Okay. So let's put some quotes around legal language is understood. But by and large, people understand what they can do and cannot, and they're trying to find ways around. I think the ethical side is companies should contribute. You don't want leeches around. And history shows those leeches will not succeed. They might have a short increase in revenue, profit, whatever. But in the long run, they will be passed on the right and on the left by companies who play with the open source system and in the open source system instead of just using it.
Yeah, I've heard that perspective. First, I agree with you. I think that if you're using open source, you should contribute to open source. And it doesn't have to be code. There's a lot of ways to contribute without giving code. In fact, I would argue in a lot of ways, there's more important ways to contribute than giving code. But I don't know that I agree with history has shown that eventually you'll be surpassed as a whole. Now, I will agree with you that if you're a company, like if you are a Postgres company and you are not contributing to Postgres, Postgres will eventually overtake you, in which case you need to figure out another way to bring value to your product. And a good example is Timescale. They've experienced this. Timescale for a long time, their extension was the only way to do what they did. It was very cool. But they saw the writing on the wall, and because Postgres was catching up with their abilities that they had extended. And so they had to shift their market a bit, and now they're primarily a database as a service company. Right?
Yep.
But there are lots of companies out there that are doing disgustingly well on the backs of open source without necessarily contributing. Apple, VMware, Broadcom, JP Morgan. I mean, Microsoft. Microsoft does not, I mean, granted, Microsoft does contribute a lot to the Linux kernel, but most of Microsoft stuff is still closed. They have a few things.
Oh, yeah, Microsoft stuff is still closed. I give you that. And I'm pretty sure, I mean, the CEO said it at some point, they couldn't, even if they wanted to, open source Windows because they acquired some of the source code and they don't have the rights to do it. But that doesn't mean other areas of the company are not playing within the rules of the open source ecosystem.
Well, they do to some degree.
They were like number two in terms of commits to the Linux kernel.
Yeah, well, and I mentioned that, but it's very here's a perfect example in our world. Let's talk about PostgreSQL and Microsoft for a second. You would think that the Windows installer for PostgreSQL at this point now, not when it first came out, but at this point now, because supposedly Microsoft considers PostgreSQL first-class product as a service or services and product for them, they would be the one to deliver an installer for Postgres on Windows. Seems to make sense, right? That they would be the one doing that. I've actually talked to Microsoft about this. Do you know what their response was? We've looked into it. It's too hard.
Yeah, and then you
run into... I shit you not!
Yeah, I get it. But keep in mind, we're talking about a gigantic company. It's one of those cases where the right hand doesn't even know the left hand exists.
Oh, that's true.
And not just with Microsoft, with all a company that size. And then you always have like a very influential legal department that comes in. But on the other hand, when Azure was designed and developed, I remember before it was published, talked to one of their product managers. And back then, like 2012-ish, he told me, we are very well aware that the most open cloud wins. So the design from the get-go was, we have to be open. And nowadays, you see like 2/3 of the VMs running in Azure are Linux VMs. Something like that. I don't have the exact numbers. So in that area of Microsoft, I think they do quite a bit and they want to do quite a bit. That doesn't mean it's easy or it's always easy for the company, but they are definitely putting money into open source community. Maybe not into Postgres that much as much as we would like. Maybe, I don't know. But they're putting stuff, putting work and money into other areas. And
well, I mean, VS Code. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, yeah. VS Code is like the default platform now for developers.
Yeah, so it's just one example. I think they put quite a bit of money into Kubernetes, for example, as well. Again, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But there are certain areas where they put money in. Google puts money elsewhere. Amazon puts money somewhere. So I'm not saying they all do well. They could certainly improve, no doubt about it. But there are definitely companies out there that are worse.
Oh,
in my opinion.
Yeah, and I'm not, don't get me wrong, I'm not necessarily arguing that Microsoft is bad, although, I mean, we come from the 90s version of Microsoft, so there's some discussion there.
Yeah.
But I do think there's, when we talk about ethically, it is a good thing to get back to open source if you're using open source. You know, one of the problems I think is, one, a lot of people don't realize that they're using open source. I mean, in fact, you can't not use open source anymore, right?
Correct.
You can't, right? I mean, if you're browsing the web, you're using open source. If you have one of the 86% of the world population that runs Android, you're running Linux.
You know what? This always gives me interesting, well, stares when I say it at some event, that there is this tiny piece of software on every Android device that I wrote.
Really?
People are
like, which one is it?
Seriously? I wrote a small tool called stat that just takes the Linux kernel stat call and displays it in a nice and fancy way.
Yeah, and gives you all the info of the file or whatever.
Right, right. The meta info, essentially. And that was moved into the GNU utils, or what was it? Core utils, whatever it is now. And that was used to put it into BusyBox, which is on all those Android devices.
You check the source code.
Yeah, I did.
I had no idea that you were that level of geek.
In all fairness, I had a tool that did something similar on a Unix system I inherited at university, but only at the binary. I couldn't find the source code, so I re-implemented it.
So this is interesting. You know, as you know, I'm more of an infrastructure architecture type of guy. I'm not really a developer. I mean, I've done some development, but it's not my gift. We had John Callis, who is, you know, the co-creator of PGP,
mm-hmm.
on more than once. And I think that a lot of people, I've known you for 20 years. I didn't know you wrote stat. And it's just, it's a simple little utility, but it is, and the reason this is so amazing to me is a few years ago, Google tried to recruit me. And I was like, you know, why the hell not? I'll have the conversation, right? So I went through the part of the interview process. And one of the things that they asked me is, what is the command to get the metadata about a file? And I'm like, stat. And they're like, well done. And now my brother, my older brother from another mother.
And another father.
And another father who I have had drank scotch in many different countries, including China with, informs me out of nowhere that he wrote the damn thing.
Yep.
And as impressive as that is, what's more impressive to everyone that listens to this, you are using it in one way. You maybe not, probably not directly, but you, the user, the consumer of an Android product or a Linux product, are using Michael Mesk's code.
Correct. Again, it's a small, very, very tiny piece of software in the larger picture of Android, but still.
But, brother, this is going to outlive you, right? I mean, that is literally a worldly contribution. You are not just an obnoxious German. You have actually contributed something useful.
Wait. Be careful. Gotta meet you in person again. Obnoxious drum. Okay, got it.
But no, I mean, on a serious note, I mean, really, you have, I mean, should there ever be a Wikipedia page about you, that's something that literally can be said that Michael Maskes, Dr. Michael Maskes, contributed to the worldwide ecosystem, the computing ecosystem, by the development of the essential program, STAT. I mean, it is just a small utility, but it is essential, right? It's not, you use it for all kinds of stuff in development.
Yeah.
I'm impressed. Not much impresses me. That I'm impressed. I mean, I'm a cynical, you know, person. That impresses me. Well done, sir. it's kind of like a lot of people don't realize, you know, chances are you are also running a piece of Tom Lane software. LibJPEG, yeah, right? So if you're viewing a graphic on the web, chances are, you know, you're using his software. So that's actually, and, you know, I know him too. It's weird. It's weird to think that, you know, these minor contributions have major societal impact.
Yeah, but I think this comes from us doing it for that long.
Okay,
you do contribute.
Sure.
And when we started, there wasn't much of an open source movement. There were just a few people here and a few people there. So it was much smaller, and everyone knew almost everyone else.
Yes. Well, I mean, that's true. I remember, you know, there's a lot of people who aren't in the community anymore, like Matt Walsh and things like that. There's projects have long gone by, like the Linux Documentation Project. You know, I was a core member on that for a while. You know, I wrote a bunch of how-tos. In fact, I don't have it anymore, it looks like, but, you know, I have a book here somewhere where four of my how-tos were published. So, you know, being around that long, definitely there's a side effect to that. But I think that my point is that there are a lot of people out there that wonder what their contributions mean as a whole in society.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just a peg in a hole, right? And this conversation right here is an illustration of how the smallest contribution can have a literal worldwide impact.
Well, at least
it may be a side effect.
It's there. I mean, somebody uses it. Somebody on the system side uses it, or some software uses it. Otherwise, it wouldn't be there.
Yeah, but I mean, it's just that one little thing, right? I mean, it's an interesting way to look at it. I mean, it's hard to think about, you know, as you get older. Well, actually, I find there's two points in your life where you significantly consider your impact or value. One, when you're young, where am I going? What am I doing? How do I be hopefully you're saying, how do I be a good contributor to society? And then when you get older, what have I done? Did I do anything good? You know, those types of things. And it's something that I think would be good for people to understand is that, just by doing that little bit of pay it forward, whatever it may be, you can affect great change over time, even if you never know about it.
Right.
So, you know, we've talked a lot about a lot of different things, but we've got a little bit of time left. Let's talk about some things that are in the news as we speak. Let's talk about Red Hat.
Yeah, I was waiting for that.
what is your take on the mighty Red Hat changing its way of doing things?
Well, the interesting question is it Red Hat changing? Or is it, as Stephen Von Nichols suggested, IBM changing things for Red Hat? And even if it's IBM changing, is it a C-level decision? Or is it the legal department? Or is it, I don't know, a profit situation. I don't know. I have no idea. I have no insights. I wasn't privy to any of those conversations. I don't think it's a wise move, though. And that brings us back to the topic we had earlier with the live in open source society, in open source communities, be part of the ecosystem. What they're doing now is the classical reflex of a company. Oh, the profits are shrinking. The revenue is shrinking. I have no idea what the background is, or the reason is. But I guess somebody made the decision that they could make more money if they do it this way. And screw open source. Who cares? We want to make more money. In the long run, I don't think that's a wise move.
So, you know, I've read a lot about what they're doing, and it's completely legit what they're doing, legally speaking.
Yeah.
I don't know that I agree, because I don't think that Red Hat is going to stop contributing, right? I don't think that they're going to become a leech off of the open source ecosystem, right? I just think that what they're saying to themselves is that for a very long time, CentOS was a pain in our ass. Then we took over CentOS and then we changed CentOS for what we think, being Red Hat, is for the better. And so Alma and Rocky and then one other that I don't remember come about. And that's to replace the traditional CentOS. And Red Hat's saying to themselves, look, yes, we're open source, but it's time. This is a very real problem I know that Red Hat has, because I will tell people to do this. I used to tell people to do this. Buy one Red Hat license so that you can deploy, get whatever it is that you need, and then deploy CentOS for everything else. That's a very real problem, and they're addressing that through their changes. And I think it's a legit change in that vein, because they contribute an ungodly amount of resources to open source. And as long as they're not violating the legal rules of open source, and they continue to contribute back, I have no problem with what they're doing. If they stop contributing, then I would have a problem.
Fair enough. If they keep contributing, they still live within the norms of the open source ecosystem. Yeah. I agree. The question is, will they still be seen as an open source company? Red Hat used to claim they would only do open source. Well, technically, right. I think this has never been true. But now they have a vendor lock mechanism in place for the open source distribution. The big question is, how will people like it? And will it still be relevant in the age of cloud?
Well, I think there's two points to that. One, I think part of this is a defensive measure against the cloud. I think
Agreed.
Part of it.
Agreed.
But the second part of it is, if you look at the companies that are buying RHEL, where their real money's coming from, it's the companies that don't care whether it's open source or not. JP Morgan does not care. There is nothing in their mandate that says use open source. There is a mandate that says use only Red Hat Enterprise Linux.
Yes, now. There is that mandate now. And they only use Red Hat Enterprise Linux because they needed something to run software X, Y, or Z, or somebody figured out it's cheaper than the traditional Unix or Windows or whatever.
Well, there's also the indemnification.
Yeah, right. That's the reason why they went for Red Hat instead of using, let's say, Debian.
Correct.
The question is, will that change? Because the vendor lock-in, I've seen a lot of situations in the open source world where they tried different vendor lock-in mechanisms. And I would say it almost never worked the way they expected it to. People go to open source software because they want to get away from these vendor logins. They want to get away from a situation where they can get dictated new prices. Oh, the revenue is going down. We're going to increase our maintenance fee by 20%. Now they're trying to make it harder to move away. True. But as you've seen from the SUSE announcement, they already see an opening there.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. And I agree with your premise, but then we have a bigger problem. If your premise is true, and I would hold the same premise for a certain segment of the market, but if the concern was lock-in, nobody would be in the cloud because that's the ultimate lock-in. The cloud is, and people are like, well, no, they're all using open source, they're all using open APIs, blah, blah, blah. No, you're writing, when you deploy on Amazon, granted, you have a choice. You can just run EC2 and Debian or whatever and do what you want. But by far, majority of people are writing to Amazon, regardless of the technology. Remember that probably 90% of PostgreSQL growth has nothing to do with PostgreSQL. It's RDS, which is not PostgreSQL. It is a service for PostgreSQL, which is happens to also be a fork. I'm not saying it's a bad service, but they are locking you in.
Yes, it's a similar situation. I agree with that. But I've seen several companies, or actually talked to several companies, who wanted to be in a situation where they can easily move from, let's say, Amazon to Microsoft or to Google, whatever, or to some of the second tier cloud providers, because they don't want that login. And larger companies have like a multi-tier or multi-cloud strategy.
Yes.
So they try to use them all interchangeably. I think, yes, they try to lock you in. Maybe so far people haven't noticed, at least not a large amount of them. But I still have my issues with any vendor lock-in.
No, I do too. And I mean, it's one of my number one. So I have a couple of arguments against not using the cloud, because you and I have been using the cloud since the 90s. It just wasn't a marketing term, right? We had virtual hosting or whatever. That's not my concern. My concern is people who say to themselves, I'm running Linux, and it happens to be Amazon's Linux. I'm running Debezium or Kafka, but it's not Debezium or Kafka. It's Amazon's version. I'm running PostgreSQL, but it's not PostgreSQL. It's Aurora or RDS. And let me be clear. Amazon, I don't know about their other stuff, but I know for PostgreSQL, they are a great contributor to PostgreSQL. They are the number four top contributor directly to the project. And they also are doing a lot of open source projects with PostgreSQL, like TLE. And I can't remember the other one, what the other one's called, but it's a Microsoft SQL competitor using PostgreSQL. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to take away from that. But like Azure or like Google or Amazon, if you write to those, you haven't really improved your situation. In fact, you're guaranteeing yourself not only lock-in, but more expensive hosting.
I cannot agree more, to be honest. Now, keep in mind, I'm coming from a country where cloud isn't that broadly used. Yet,
right.
Maybe. And GDPR alone makes people think about keeping their systems on site. But yeah, I agree. There are new cloud providers coming up with exactly those, selling points. This is only standard community Postgres. We're not doing anything else. I think, isn't that what Microsoft also says? It's just community Postgres they run as a service?
I think they call it flexible server or something like that, is, yeah, just Postgres. It's not anything special. I mean, I shouldn't say special. It's not anything different, except they for obvious reasons, they locked out SuperUser.
Yeah, but that's a different thing. I mean, it's still
like I said,
standard Postgres. So if you want to move your data over to some other cloud provider and some other standard Postgres, maybe on site, you can do it. So in that term, there is no vendor lock-in.
Yeah, I mean, and you can do the same with Amazon or Google.
Right.
It's just a matter of, I don't know, I think my concern, well, I mean, in 2009, we had, PostgreSQL East in New York. and we had a panel about the cloud. And this is when Heroku was the only provider for Postgres, right? And it all boiled down to the same thing, is that marketing people who largely don't know what they're doing but do know how to inspire people to spend money got cloud and went for it. And now I think why it's frustrating for me is, and probably for Creditive when Creditive was still doing this stuff, is that we spend a lot of time fixing the mistakes of people who bought into marketing. Right? I mean, we make a lot of money doing that. We make a lot of money finding different ways to tell people, you're a moron, we need to fix this. Right? Now, we don't actually say that. We say, well, we understand that you received this value from this platform, but what we're saying is that this platform has created limitations based on your scale, and we need to migrate you out. Had they called us before they migrated to the platform, they never would even have had that conversation. But they always call us after.
Yeah, they try doing things themselves, and then they only call us when they run into issues.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a normal thing. But I had one of those very early cloud conversations too about our business model, as in the service provider. We run your database, we run your whatever installation. And I remember one guy telling me, oh, I'm sorry for you guys because you're going to go out of business. Nobody needs you anymore because the cloud providers take over.
I still hear that.
Yeah, right. But the more we get people move into the cloud, the better our business is. Because the cloud providers only make sure you have that database as a service. The technical installation is there. They don't touch your data.
That's right.
They don't care about, or well, they might care, but they just don't have the team to take care of query optimization or whatever. So if you don't have your own DBA or you want to get rid of your DBAs, it doesn't help to just go to Amazon or Microsoft. You need somebody who is willing to actually take care of the data inside your database.
The biggest lie cloud providers tell people is that the service is managed.
To some extent, they're right, but only to some extent.
But it's not from, so, you know, we're in Postgres, so let's talk about RDS. They didn't replace the DBA, they replaced the SRE.
Yeah.
Right, but they market it that they've replaced the DBA. And it's just simply not true. And to be fair, Amazon's made my life in some ways easier too, because I no longer have to run a base backup and then initiate, you know, binary replication. I click a button, right? That's great. But it didn't eliminate all the other stuff that you have to do to get it to perform, right?
Right.
On that, as we're getting a little long on the episode here, I want to go back to one thing, because I was surprised about this. I think I actually knew this, but I don't follow it. So when I saw it in the notes, I thought, let's talk about this. My German friend has an unhealthy addiction to American football.
Why is it unhealthy?
Oh, because American
football. I don't play. I've watched.
Well, I hope not. Good Lord. So I take issue not just with American football, but I take issue with a lot of professional sports. I find that, and don't get me wrong, I think it's awesome that people can make a living as an athlete. If that is your gift, that is your passion, go for it. No problem. The problem I have is the number of felons, the number of crimes swept under the rug, the obscene amounts of money that they make. And then, don't get me wrong, there are good people that are giving back to the communities and trying to make better lives and all that kind of thing. I'm not taking away from that. And obviously, the press makes a lot of this more enlightened or available to people than probably actually represents the problem. But then if you also get into the health, a lot of football players, as they start to retire, and I think that we're starting to see that's why we're starting to see people retiring earlier than they used to in football, is because they're broken.
Yeah, interesting.
Beaten to death.
Interesting. Interesting that you bring that up. I just read an article the other day about the soccer goalkeeper who decided to retire at age 21 because he was afraid of his body not holding up.
Yeah.
And yes, there is an issue there. They might be overtrained. I don't really worry too much about the money involved. It's more like entertainment. And if you can do something that nobody else can but millions want to watch, you should be compensated well.
Agreed. And I think that's – I'm going to say something a little controversial, which I never do. But right. I think that's why the WNBA suffers. It's not that these ladies aren't talented. It's not that they're not gifted. It's not that they're not good at what they do. People don't – the larger population doesn't watch the WNBA, so they don't make the money that the NFL makes. It's the same thing with like the XFL. The XFL is an interesting side project, but it does not make the money that the NFL does. So you're not going to walk into the XFL and make $50 million a year, right? It's because the NFL is a cash machine.
Right. And some of that creates issues. I mean, this, you name the league, you name the sports, they all have similar issues. Back to the felony issues or the felons that are playing, I think the system we have here when it comes to professional sports is different. So it's not school and then college and then professional league. It's more like, I guess, the way soccer is done in the US as well. It's on the side. You have a club you play with or for. Mm-hmm. And maybe you move to a higher club at a certain level. But even then, young kids are called the hero, are called the best for all of their life. And people do crazy things. I remember talking to a coach way back when he had like a test for the highest level, but kids age 9, and the father approached him and asked him where the training or the tryout was. Mm-hmm. And he's like, yeah, it's over there, but 3 hours early, so you might want to do something else. Why are you here that early? Oh yeah, we came from there and there, like a 2-hour drive away. And he's like, seriously? You want to bring him to practice like 3 times a week and a game on the weekend and always drive 2 hours per direction? Yeah. Because he's supposed to become a pro. And it's like, the kid is 9 years old. There's no way to get you predict him getting there.
That's true. But on the other hand, I think there's something to be said. One, I think that at 9, doesn't matter what sport it is, but at 9, the sport should be a game. Right. It should not be a profession. But I also do understand, I mean, take Tiger Woods. Now, he's obviously, through the past few years, all kinds of health issues, but there was a period of time for almost 20 years where people trembled if they had to play against him.
Yeah.
I mean, to this day, he's like 47 years old. And I just read an article about him. He was playing against a younger player who is more highly ranked than Tiger is now, for obvious reasons. But Tiger doesn't – you golf – Tiger doesn't take divots on his drives. Okay. And the guy was like, what? And he's like, yeah, no, I never take it. If my swing is dialed in, I never divot. I just sweep. That's unheard of. That's the level of precision that he's achieved. But that's been achieved because he's been playing golf since he was like 4.
Yes, you have to start early. That's true. You have to start very early. It doesn't matter which sport it is. You have to start early, but it still has to be a game. And yes, Tiger was immensely talented, and he still put a lot of effort into it. And there we get to the point again. He made an awful lot of money by golfing the way he did. But yes, he was able to golf in a way that nobody else could.
Well, I mean,
he kind of deserved the money.
Yeah, no, and I'm not. When I say obscene amounts of money, I mean, you know, I'm not anti-money. It's more that I've gotten to a point in my life where I realize that there's a lot of wealth out there that is squandered, and that's my concern. I don't care. Let's take Bill Gates, one of the richest men in the world, billions and billions and billions of dollars. He made his money controversially, but now he gives back.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ways he gives back is he's investing in farms to make those farms financially viable.
Mm-hmm.
For example. So it's not that I have a problem with someone making $100 million a year for shooting hoops or playing football or whatever. It's that we have raised a lot of these young men who are making this kind of money without a value system that contributes to society. And I'm not talking about whether they're Christian or Muslim, or I don't give a damn about that. I'm talking about specifically responsibility to oneself and the understanding of the responsibility to oneself contains a responsibility to society. If
the biggest, you grew the biggest up, issue is, yeah, the biggest issue I see there, you do stupid things as a kid. Everyone does.
Sure. Yeah.
But if you're that great an athlete, the coach will make sure you don't get penalized for it. Everything is left under the rug, whatever. And you grow up that way. So it doesn't matter what you do. Everything gets swept under the rug. You can do whatever you want. You're immune to that. And that creates persons that have an issue. I'm not saying everyone is that way. Absolutely not.
Yeah, no, not everyone.
I know a lot of, actually, my neighbor is an ex-professional soccer player. Certainly not one of these. But there are, I'm not even sure they make it to that level, but I've seen kids with that mindset, which is just ridiculous. They do stupid stuff and tell you, I don't care. Nobody's going to penalize me for that anyway, because I'm good at what I do. This is not what we want people to grow up with.
Well, no, because you end up with people who, when they finally fall, they fall so far, they never make it back. Because right. They didn't have consequences for their actions ever. Right? They don't even, you can't even blame them. Right? It's their responsibility, hands down. But there's definitely an argument. It's like, look, if someone tells you you're the greatest all your life, and then all of a sudden you're not the greatest, you're not going to know how to deal with that.
Yeah, and keep in mind, they tell them you're the greatest in their formative years, which is probably the worst thing you can do.
Well, yeah, because everything's still developing.
Right.
You know? So who's your favorite American football team?
The 49ers.
San Francisco 49ers. Really?
Absolutely.
I would have thought you would have been more of a New York Giants or
the
Patriots. Well, no, not Patriots. That would be anti-German.
why is that anti-German? Well, anyway.
Because it's the American Patriots, not the German Patriots. Just stupid joke.
Whatever.
So the 49ers.
Don't ask me how I got into the 49ers. I simply don't know.
I stopped watching. The only sport I follow, and I don't watch it, I just follow it, is golf. And that's just because I love to play the game. I can't play it like I used to, but I enjoy playing golf, and so I follow it. I don't follow basketball or football or anything like that. I can't even tell you, like, when I found out a week after that the Super Bowl had happened.
Okay, that doesn't happen to me. But I agree. I like following golf. I also follow soccer. Well, at least the local one. But it's not a major part of my life. I just enjoy it.
Yeah. of course.
If I get a chance to either watch like the golf tournament or the football game or go onto the course and play a round of golf myself, it's the latter I do. I'm going to walk my 18 holes every time before I start watching something.
Fair enough. All right. Is there anything that you would like to add to this episode?
Nope.
Good.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And with that, this has been More Than a Refresh, a podcast about data and the people who wrangle it. Our guest today was Dr. Michael Mesks, a worldwide contributor to the betterment of man through a small piece of code called STAT.